Israeli forces fatally shoot a Palestinian man in the West Bank as anger mounts over the regime's controversial open fire rules. Nigeria destroys more than a million doses of expired COVID-19 vaccines, blaming vaccine nationalism for accepting jabs with short shelf lives. Also coming up, France reports over 84,000 new COVID-19 infections, coming close to an all-time high the country had recorded in November 2020. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour: Israeli forces open fire on a car, killing one Palestinian in the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. 26-year-old Mohammed Isa Abbas succumbed to wounds he sustained after he was shot in the back. He was taken to a nearby hospital in a critical condition, but attempts to save him failed. The incident comes as the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams new Israeli rules that give the regime's soldiers more freedom to use deadly force against Palestinians. It says the new Israeli rules show Israeli military leaders criminal behaviors that are based on terrorism and the deliberate killing of innocent people. The new rule allows Israeli soldiers to shoot at Palestinians who throw stones, even if they do not pose an imminent threat. Palestinian journalist Dawood Kutab believes that the new Israeli open fire rules in the West Bank are a violation of international law.
Well, there's two issues here. First of all, on the political level, Israel's prime minister has told Mr. Biden, and has actually acted on that, that he has no plans of negotiating a settlement of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. He's not interested in a two-state solution, and he's not even willing to meet with the Palestinian leadership. So there is no political horizon for Palestinians. There is no future that Palestinians will be free from occupation. And the very basic issue of legitimate resistance, popular resistance, it's legitimized and allowed in international conventions, is now a death threat. I mean, they are actually green-lighting and legitimizing the assassination of Palestinians simply for throwing stones. And it's a war crime, because war crimes, in terms of a conflict, you have to use proportional use of weapons. You cannot shoot at somebody throwing stones at you. That is not proportional at all.
Reports coming out of Iraq suggest an attack on a U.S. logistics convoy in the south of the country. Iraqi media say multiple roadside bombs targeted the convoy in Muthenna governorate. Still no reports of casualties or possible damage. American troops, as well as their military and logistics convoys, have repeatedly come under attack over the past year. The attacks escalated after the U.S. assassinated top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis in January 2020. Their killings gave a rise to calls for the expulsion of American forces from Iraq. Earlier this month, the U.S. ended its combat mission there and limited it to an advisory one. American Army veteran Seth Manzel says Washington's failures in Iraq are fanning the flame of anti-U.S. sentiments there.
It's not entirely clear which group are responsible for this, but the continued presence of the U.S. forces are definitely inflaming things there. And since did such a terrible job of eliminating ISIS, we're suffering the consequences of that, and also moreover the Iraqi people are suffering the consequences of that.
Saudi warplanes have reportedly carried out fresh airstrikes in Yemen's capital as the kingdom intensifies a devastating war on its neighbor. The report said the kingdom's operation in Sana'a came after the Yemeni army's drone attack on Jizan. On Monday, Saudi warplanes carried out three airstrikes on Sana'a International Airport. Yemeni officials said the air raids disrupted services at the airport, leading to a halt to the delivery of UN humanitarian aid supplies. Riyadh, along with some of its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed in the onslaught. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution offers his condolences for the passing away of the Iranian envoy to Yemen. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei says Hassan Irlou was a persevering and efficient ambassador. The leader said Irlou's proud portfolio boasts a collection of political and diplomatic efforts as well as social movements. Hassan Irlou passed away due to complications from COVID-19 in Tehran on Tuesday. He is remembered for his endeavors to facilitate the supply of humanitarian aid to Yemen that's been hit by the devastating Saudi war.
Hassan Irlou was born in 1959 in Shahrare, a small town near Tehran. After the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, he joined the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was a veteran of the Iran-Iraq War and had been suffering from complications of chemical attacks. Irlou went on to become a senior diplomat. After Yemen's conflict broke out in 2015, he was transferred to Department for Yemen's Affairs at Iran's Foreign Ministry, where he served as deputy assistant to the minister. During that period, Irlou coordinated the transfer of Iranian humanitarian aid to Yemen, in cooperation with the United Nations. In October 2020, he was appointed as Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government. In that portfolio, Irlou focused his efforts on unifying resistance groups and strived for national reconciliation. He encouraged Yemeni political groups to resolve their internal disputes through dialogue. The senior diplomat also worked towards garnering international support for mechanisms that would end the Yemen conflict and lift the blockade imposed by the Saudi military coalition. Irlou was diagnosed with COVID-19 days before he was transferred to Tehran from Sana'a to receive medical treatment. But by the time he arrived at a hospital in Iran's capital on Sunday, his condition had worsened irrevocably. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that's because certain countries delayed his flight out of Sana'a. Khatibzadeh did not name any specific country, but Saudi Arabia and its allies in the war have been keeping Yemen under a blockade since 2015. The main airport in Sana'a has been closed for more than 5 years now. Hassan Irlou passed away on Tuesday morning due to complications from COVID-19. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has expressed its condolences to Tehran.
Now, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps have held the third day of large-scale military drills in the south of the country. The IRGC's ground forces successfully performed offensive and defensive operations using new military weapons, equipment, and modern techniques. The forces hit identified targets with heavy and semi-heavy weapons after receiving intelligence on a hypothetical enemy. An advanced homegrown tank capable of withstanding heat waves was used for the first time. The five-day maneuvers are codenamed the Great Prophet 17. They are carried out in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz regions, as well as the coasts of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The drills involve a variety of IRGC units. Iran regularly holds military drills to enhance the combat readiness of its armed forces. Earlier, we were joined by journalist and political commentator Mustafa Khoshchesh. He explains why the ongoing military drills in Iran are significant and what message they send.
Well, you know that the Great Prophet series of drills, are routine exercises that happen annually. But now, in this time, it's sending direct messages to the Americans, to the Israelis, and to those Western powers in the Vienna talks that have been trying to, blackmail Iran through military threats by the Israeli regime and the bathtub-good-cup game that they started right from the beginning or even before the beginning of the Vienna talks. You know, in some kind of demarcation dispute, the Israelis and Americans, they've been, picking up the roles of the good cop and bad cop in the Vienna talks, trying to give credibility to military threats against Iran that was lost actually after the Iranian missile strike and Ainul Assad shooting down a Global Hawk and many other scenes in the Persian Gulf. And as they started the talks, they tried to appoint or assign the Israelis to this bad cop role, but the Israeli regime has failed already in playing a convincing role, since it went to the extremes. It radicalized the tone of the threats in quantity and quality.
Moving on to other news now, Nigeria destroys more than a million doses of expired AstraZeneca vaccines in a bid to allay public concerns. COVID vaccines were donated by rich Western nations. Several months ago, a medical expert in the Ministry of Health said Nigeria knew the vaccines had a short shelf life, but it had to take the doses due to a shortage of supplies on the continent. Faisal Shoaib stressed that the vaccines were not available because of, quote, vaccine nationalism. He accused rich countries of hoarding the jabs and donating them at the point they were about to expire. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization chief has warned that the rush in wealthy countries to roll out additional COVID doses is deepening inequity and prolonging the pandemic.
Blanket booster programs are likely to prolong the pandemic rather than ending it by diverting supply to countries that already have high levels of vaccination coverage, giving the virus more opportunity to spread and mutate.
Tedros warned that no country can boast or boost that is its way out of the pandemic. He also stressed that the vast majority of hospitalizations and deaths are among unvaccinated, not unboosted people. The WHO chief said the Omicron variant is spreading at an unprecedented speed and has already been detected in 106 countries. However, Tedros said the existing vaccines continue to provide significant protection against severe illness caused by Omicron. Political commentator Abiyomi Ezekwe says many people in developed countries are hesitant to get vaccinated while there are not enough jabs in developing countries.
Even here in the United States, there are huge pockets of vaccine hesitancy. People who will not take the vaccine, who fear the vaccine more than they do the COVID-19 virus and its various variants. This is a major problem as well. So you can imagine in developing states, you have the hesitancy, but at the same time, you have these infrastructural problems, the lack of consistent power supply, transportation issues, instability, for example, in Nigeria, in the Northeast, in the Northwest, and even certain sections of the central part of the country, which makes it a security issue in regard to distributing the vaccine. So it's a monumental problem, and it needs to be rethought by these major producers of the vaccines in the West, and also the international humanitarian agencies such as the World Health Organization.
We're going to stay with some coronavirus news now, and Europe once again becomes a COVID hotspot as daily infections reach record highs in different countries. The fast-spreading Omicron variant is being blamed for the surge. New daily cases now surpass 106,000 in Britain, the highest daily tally in the country since the pandemic began. Elsewhere in Western Europe, France says it's on a war path against Omicron. The country reports over 84,000 new cases, its second highest tally this year. The French government predicts that daily cases will hit 100,000 there by the end of the year. Neighboring Italy is also witnessing a rise in its 24-hour infections. The COVID surge has already prompted some European countries to tighten restrictions just ahead of the New Year holidays. Germany is one of them. The country says it will limit private gatherings to 10 Turning elsewhere, a speech by the Turkish president following a cabinet meeting has helped the lira gain 20% against the US dollar. The president vowed to control the currency and implement a plan to stop the lira from losing its value. Rashan Saglam is in Istanbul.
Turkish lira gained 20% on Monday following a speech by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The recovery followed a series of decisions announced by the president in a presser after the cabinet meeting. He said the new measures will encourage Turks to keep their savings in local currency instead of exchanging it to US dollar and euro.
We are presenting a new financial alternative to citizens who want to alleviate their concerns stemming from the rise in exchange rates when they evaluate their savings. Investors will be encouraged to move towards Turkish lira-based assets by issuance of government bills that are indexed to public economic enterprise revenues that are transferred to the budget.
Erdogan also said the Turkish government will help exporters who find it difficult to present the prices in foreign exchange rates due to fluctuation. He said that the government goes ahead with its lower interest rates plan as promised.
I don't think the Turkish lira will gain back its previous value against the US dollar. However, I think it will not lose value anymore. With the latest decisions taken by the president and the control the central bank is planning to have on the currency, along with the export plans Turkish government is working on, I think the government will be able to control the situation more, and we can say the crisis is contained.
The Turkish lira was at 18.4 against the US dollar before the president's speech, and stood at 11.3 after it. The lira gaining value rapidly forced people to exchange the US dollar they had into Turkish lira in fear that the rate will go further down. However, the lira lost some of this value Tuesday morning and stood at 13.4 against the US dollar. No one here expected Erdogan's speech to have such an impact. Despite the wild swings, the lira is still down more than 40% against the dollar year to date. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Silicon Valley has become infamous for its role in the surveillance ecosystem, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sam Knight Ryder. This article is published under the heading Apple Employee Blows Whistle on Illegal Spying and Toxic Working Conditions. Stay tuned for more. Silicon Valley has become infamous for its role in the surveillance ecosystem, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Bosses are increasingly using an array of tech industry tools to keep constant tabs on their employees working from home, despite statistics showing that those who work remotely are more productive than their counterparts toiling away in office buildings. But one woman who worked for the tech industry's biggest company is fighting back. Ashley Giowick, a former Apple project manager who was fired in September after speaking out about workplace safety concerns, has asked labor regulators to rule that the company employs illegal surveillance tactics. In October, Giowick filed a complaint with the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, accusing Apple of a number of unfair labor practices, including keeping tabs on employees in a manner that prevents them from exercising their right to discuss working conditions. Giowick also alleged that the company violated the National Labor Relations Act, NLRA, by retaliating against her for voicing concerns about workplace safety stemming from the fact that Apple's office building in Sunnyvale, California, is situated on top of an Environmental Protection Agency EPA designated Superfund site, an area contaminated by hazardous industrial waste that is supposed to have been cleaned up and contained if humans are in the vicinity. Giowick prevails, the NLRB could issue a ruling curtailing employers' abilities to surveil workers and chill their speech. Giowick has filed numerous other complaints with several environmental and workplace safety regulators and the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, and has been meticulous in documenting her experience as demonstrated by her personal website. This week, the Department of Labor ruled that Giowick's complaints had merit and that the agency's Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, would be investigating her whistleblower retaliation complaints. Whistleblowing law expert Stephen Kahn told the Financial Times that it was unusual for OSHA to investigate such allegations because companies often silence and intimidate employees and because those filing charges must establish that their case is likely to succeed. Most of us know that there is some level of pollution in our day-to-day lives, but there is still a lot of trust in the government and companies to do the right thing when it comes to poisoning people, she told Truth Out. In her NLRB complaint alleging illegal surveillance by Apple, Giowick cited the company's handbook, which reserves the right to search employees' work equipment and their personal devices to protect Apple confidential and sensitive information. The company defines its proprietary information to include compensation, training, recruiting, and other human resource information. Under federal labor law, all employees have the right to discuss their working conditions for the purpose of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. The NLRB has ruled that management cannot spy on employees exercising their rights. The Apple handbook includes a footnote stating that the company is not attempting to restrict its employees' rights to speak freely about wages, hours, or working conditions as legally permitted. But Apple policy also generally forbids employees from making any public disclosures without prior approval, including statements to the press, and it orders employees to refrain from discussing compensation, training, recruiting, and other human resource information after leaving the company, which it attempts to enforce through non-disclosure agreements. The handbook also bars employees from sharing information about their co-workers' compensation, health information, or performance in disciplinary matters without any footnotes about rights to speak freely about wages, hours, or working conditions, according to Gilwick's complaint. Charges that Gilwick filed with NLRB also cite a memo circulated by Apple CEO Tim Cook after details of a meeting featuring discussion of pay equity was leaked to the press. Cook responded to the disclosure by vowing to identify those who leaked and by saying people who leak confidential information do not belong here. Contradicting any stated policy granting employees the right to discuss their working conditions. Gilwick also told Truthout when she informed someone on Apple's employee resources team that she had the legal right to speak publicly about working conditions, he replied, "Most people don't figure that out." In response to questions about Gilwick and Apple workplace activists, Apple has typically declined to make specific comments. For example, the company told Slate, "We are and have always been deeply committed to creating and maintaining a positive and inclusive workplace. We take all concerns seriously and we thoroughly investigate whenever a concern is raised and out of respect for the privacy of any individuals involved. We do not discuss specific employee matters." Apple has not responded to Truthout's request for comment on Gilwick's claim that a member of its employee resources team told her that the majority of Apple employees aren't aware of their rights in the workplace.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us again on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. First and foremost, I'd like to apologize for my nasal voice. It's rain season and flus and colds are going around. Secondly, but more importantly, I'm joined by my special guest and darling sister, Sister Razia Shamri. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's so good to be here with you
after
such a long time.
It really has. We have a lot to talk about, some really interesting topics too. A little different from what we used to do. Some pragmatic, some trending stuff that a lot of women are dealing with. And of course, Muslim ladies are no exception to this matter. But what I understand from the little chat we had before the recording is that you intend on talking about the ever so fabulous topic of shopping.
Actually, shopping is something that whenever I myself, I feel really low in moods and I want a mood change, it's one of the options on my list.
Seriously?
It is.
It makes you feel better?
It makes me feel better.
It's your little pick-me-up, isn't it?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I see it in the women around me. It's something that my mom used to do. You know, when she was feeling very homesick, when we were not in Iran, when we were in Canada, the one thing that lifted her spirit, one of the things, was to do shopping.
Get out.
No, seriously.
That is so cute.
And that is in the corner of my mind. Mm. It's been in the corner of my mind since my childhood. And I always wondered, what is it that women love to do shopping, even when their wardrobes are, you know, exploding from different kinds of clothes? What is it psychologically that women love to do shopping, and it's the remedy? Even I remember that some couples, when they have problem, like arguments, spousal debates and discussions and like
disagreements. Yeah.
One thing that the man can use, one strategy, is to take her shopping and to get her something, and then she'll feel better, and then they will make up.
Seriously.
No, and this was always on my mind, and I thought, like, let's do research and find out, and let's see, like, to what extent we have to do it, to what extent is approved, Islamically speaking, and let's go a little deep down to the roots.
We're gonna put shopping under the Islamic microscope.
Yeah, also, at some point of our discussion, we're going to talk about that, too.
Okay.
So should I start? You don't like shopping yourself?
No. I hate it so much.
Wow.
I hate it with passion. I hate it religiously.
So how do you do your shopping?
I shop maybe once a year. It's winter time. I need winter clothes. I need to change my boots every year because apparently my feet have teeth and they gnaw on my boots. Yeah, I just shop once a year, maybe twice a year, winter time and summertime, that's it.
Wow. And do you do it with, like, you just grab the things that you want?
Yes, yes. I go in, I grab, I come out.
Exactly the attitude of men. Yeah. And it's interesting that someone was doing a research. Actually, I was reading a short article called Why Women Love to Shop and Men Hate the Mall. I saw this as I was doing the research. I think it was CBS news channel that had published this article, and this researcher who had gone on a winter vacation with his wife and the group, he said that when it was at one point in our trip, the men wanted to go sightseeing and the women wanted to go shopping.
What?
This happens a lot. In a lot of my trips also, we have this argument that men, like one day of the trip, like even if it's a 3-day trip, one day has to be allocated to shopping.
Shop for what?
I don't know. When you go somewhere, especially when you're traveling, you have to do the shopping. You have to go see like the fashion, the designs, you know, how of that country or of that city, you know, the culture.
But what does it matter? Would you not see, okay, the trend and the fashion you can see on the people wearing clothes in the streets, in the sights you will go to see?
No, that's totally different.
And the architecture and in the food and in the streets. And
yeah. All of them are also included. But then one specific part of the trip has to be dedicated to shopping. I'm very surprised that you're a woman and you're like so disagreeing with this whole idea.
This is Muslim Lady. We are talking about the fascinating topic of shopping and why women adore it, why it revives them, it brings them back to life, and why men, well, they're not very crazy about it. I'm joined by Sister Razia Shamili, and stay with us on this discussion.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
So we're back, and we've been talking about shopping. I either need clothes, right? Or I need, like, dust collectors for the house. And they're called dust collectors for a reason. Vases and, you know, things to put around the house and stuff like that. I don't like them. I don't understand the objective, and they're called dust collectors for a reason.
That
they collect
so
dust.
That is so true. That
right?
is so true.
Or you shop for clothes. And for clothes, it's just that, I mean, how much clothes can we possibly wear?
Never enough. Seriously. I open the wardrobes of the ladies in my family and relatives, and seriously, they are exploding. Maybe, you know, sometimes there are clothes lying there that are not even used once a year.
Exactly. Never mind the fact that you have to go through the trouble of calculating the khums on these.
Exactly. Do you have to? Well, if you wear it once a year, you don't have to calculate the khums, right? So that is exactly the purpose why, Islamically speaking, you are in numerous teachings of the Quran and in the ahadith that we have from the Noble Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, we are reminded constantly that you are here in this world for a short time. and let not the glitters of this world beguile you. Mm-hmm. I was actually reading a hadith from the Noble Prophet where he was talking to the different people in different ages. He said, oh, 20-year-olds, strive and, you know, try to work hard in the second decade of your life. Oh, 30-year-olds, do this, 40, 50.
Interesting.
And at one point he said to the 30-year-olds, be careful not to let the glitters and glamour of this worldly life to beguile you.
Yeah, for sure.
And if you're looking at it from a capitalist perspective, you know, in this world that we're living, the whole purpose is to gain more profit. I mean, I'm talking from the point of view of the capitalist system, right? Mm. So they need to produce more and more every day.
Exactly.
They need more trends, more fashion, more style to be
exactly. And
on
they
display.
They make commercials and ads, and they set trends in magazines,
right?
And on the red carpets, and that just encourages consumers or people to constantly feel that if I don't buy this, I'm either out of trend or I'm not fashionable enough or I'm lame or I'm not in touch with, I'm not updated, up to date with what my peers are doing.
That is so true. And the other thing is that people's these days have become very superficial. And their eyes and their minds and their brains lie in what they see. And they don't like to go delve a little deeper into the layers of a person.
Women in Imam Khomeini's idea.
On the criterion of taqwa or piety, Imam Khomeini states, there is no difference existing between groups in Islam except in taqwa and fearing the obedience of the Almighty God. Imam Khomeini states on the subject of corruption, the benevolent spirit of the Prophet of God and the Immaculate Imams, alayhi salam, are in a state of anxiety and horror at the prospect of the leaves of the tree of the prophetic mission, wilayat, and guardianship falling and drying away. The Holy Prophet has remarked that marry in order to produce children. For verily, I take pride in you in relation with other nations, even if the child is aborted. This is from 40 hadiths that Imam Khomeini has quoted.
So we're back, and we've been talking about shopping.
Naturally, automatically, when you see someone for the first time, what attracts you to the person is the physical appearance of that person, what that person, how the style of that person, the hairstyle is, the beard style, the makeup, even the makeup, the colors that you use for your lipstick, for your shadow, the clothes that you wear, like even if you have piercing, tattoos these days are becoming so trendy. All these, I'm saying that people care about superficiality, and it's people are attracted
so much. Of course.
So if not to be fall behind from the trendy stylish people, you are somehow forced.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, I believe it's Islamic as well. We have so many narrations about how the Imams alayhi salam dressed according to their time, right? Sure,
and to their position and prestige.
Exactly.
Remember?
It was cool for Amir al-Mu'mineen to dress in coarse clothes and eat dry, stale bread because the majority of the Muslim ummah at that time were
under poverty.
Yes. It took him almost 5 years to bring everyone to a good, like, average, above average right. level. But then after that, during the times of Imam al-Sadiq or Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the Imams were fashionable and they were questioned for it too. And they're like, dude, it's like different times, you know?
Exactly.
But to an extent.
Exactly.
We always talk about how Islam is here to establish balance for us, right?
Definitely. Yeah. As far as your attention and your emphasis in life and all that you care and, you know, the core of your value system, as far as if this is shifted away from material life, because there is no end to it.
Yes.
And it's something interesting about the material world is that once you buy that thing, the second day, all that enthusiasm, all that glitter, it falls away.
Yes, exactly. And then you're filled with a deeper void.
Exactly.
It's horrible. The cycle goes on.
Exactly.
And it reminds me of that hadith from Muhammad Kadhim, alayhi salam, where his eminence says, this world and taking from this material world is like drinking seawater.
Mm.
The more you drink, the thirstier you get until you die.
Exactly.
It's scary.
It's very scary, but
that's all the time we have. The scarier part is that that's all the time we have. Thank you so very much for being with us on this episode. Thank you, Sister Razia.
Thank you.
Much more to be talked about on this discussion, so make sure to stay tuned. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the Lawwam?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
At the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel alliance is a lot stronger than any notion of democracy or human rights, says Jessica Boxbaum, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Biden administration's reluctance to spend geopolitical capital greenlights Israeli settlement push. Stay tuned for more. Recently, the Zionist regime bowed to American pressure and scrapped the controversial Atarot settlement in the Palestinian neighborhood of Ghalandia, just north of Al-Quds. But on the heels of that decision, the regime advanced another Jewish settlement in Palestinian neighborhoods along Al-Quds' southern tip, even as the residents there are grappling with a severe housing shortage. The plan is to develop a new neighborhood called Givat HaShaked on land expanding beyond the Green Line, the Zionist regime's de facto border. Before the 1967 war, which saw it occupy its Al-Quds, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and adjacent to the Palestinian neighborhood of Beit Safafa in occupied East Al-Quds. Recently, the Al-Quds Municipality Planning and Building Committee recommended the development plan for the passage, meaning it will now head to Al-Quds District Planning Committee, which will decide whether to deposit the plan for objections or public review. The project calls for construction of 473 homes, schools, and synagogues to be built on about 9 acres of open land. During the committee hearing, the Zionist regime's custodian general, the authority within the Justice Ministry overseeing properties whose owners are unknown, was represented by its economic unit director, Hanel Gorfinkel. Gorfinkel is a right-wing activist known for supporting Jewish settlements in East Al-Quds. Givat HaShaked is not the only settlement in East Al-Quds being pushed by the custodian general. Documentation obtained by Haaretz reveals Givat HaShaked is one of 6 Jewish neighborhoods the Zionist regime is currently advancing across East Al-Quds. These include one in Sheikh Jarrah, one near Damascus Gate, one in Sor Bahar, one in Beit Haniya, and another in Beit Safafa. Activists emphasize that Gorenfekel's appointment is directly intertwined with the heightened settlement activity and the displacement of Palestinians in East Al-Quds. Amy Cohen, Director of International Relations and Advocacy at Al-Quds-focused Israeli human rights organization Er Amim, said of Gorfinkel, "What we have seen is that since his appointment in 2017, there has been a substantial increase in eviction lawsuits against Palestinians and the expansion of Jewish settlements in Palestinian areas." According to Er Amim, the acreage set for Givat HaShaked is actually on land that is undergoing formal land registration in Sharafat area of Beit Safafa. The Zionist regime's 2018 decision 3790 was marketed to the public as a means to push economic development in East Al-Quds and reduce socioeconomic inequality. The initiative reserved 50 million shekels, nearly $16 million, for the registration of land rights in East Al-Quds, an important prerequisite needed to secure building permits. The Zionist regime authorities often use the absence of building permits as justification for demolishing Palestinian homes. However, as uncovered by Er Amim, land registration procedures are being used to advance Jewish settlements as found in Sheikh Jarrah, rather than develop Palestinian neighborhoods in Al-Quds. On one hand, Decision 3790 is depicted as a tool to aid Palestinians, Cohen told Minpress News, adding, and yet it's being used to further the expansion of Jewish settlement and confiscation of Palestinian land and property. Land registration is supposed to be a transparent and publicized process. Sari Kronish, East Al-Quds planner at Israeli Regime Planning Rights Organization, BIMCOM, explained. The regime is supposed to publish a map of areas of the plots and invite people to make claims. And if claims are made that contradict each other, then the registrar is supposed to send those claims to court to be clarified, Kronish said, adding, but the way the regime is actually doing it, we see that it's being done quietly. People often don't know that's happening. We don't know yet of a single case where the Palestinians will be able to benefit from it, Kronish added. The area reserved for Givat HaShaket was once sought after for development by former Zionist regime Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. In 1995, Rabin put forward a housing project for the land, sparking international outcry. The UN Security Council voted to have the Zionist regime halt the plan, with the United States vetoing the resolution. Rabin shelved his expropriation days after the UN vote in what has been speculated to be an exchange for the US veto. Now the current Zionist regime is going beyond what any previous leadership dared to. Daniel Scheidman, founder and director of Israeli nonprofit Terrestrial Al-Quds, emphasized. These settlement plans are now on the agenda, Scheidman told Minpress News, adding, relations between the United States and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett are charged at the moment. Scheidman continued, the Americans have made their concerns very clear about the settlement of E1 and Atarot. So why is Bennett having another poke in the eye over something like this? Lara Friedman, president of the American Nonprofit Foundation for Middle East Peace, FMEP, agreed the new government is stepping into territory even Bennett's predecessor wouldn't touch. They are as bad as the Benjamin Netanyahu cabinet, and in many ways, they are worse, Friedman said, adding, these settlements are absolutely incompatible with any commitment to anything other than permanent Israeli control over the entire area, Friedman added, highlighting the record number of home demolitions throughout Area C of the occupied West Bank as another way Bennett's cabinet is pushing increased annexation. From Er Amim's Cohen's perspective, despite Bennett's cabinet being a politically diverse coalition, hardline voices are the ones in power. Far-right members of the coalition are put in very strategic high-level positions like in the Ministry of Interior, Ministry of Housing, Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Justice, Cohen said. All of these portfolios are very senior and they have a lot of weight. And what we have seen is because of this, they're quietly able to advance this very far-right-wing agenda. Prominent right-wing politicians hold top spots in Israel's cabinet. Ayelet Shaked is Interior Minister. Zeev Elkin is the Minister of Housing and Construction. And Gideon Saar serves as the Minister of so-called Justice. As settlement expansion becomes the defining feature of Bennett's regime, the other side of the Atlantic is becoming increasingly more vocal about the Zionist occupation and land theft. In November 26, U.S. House Democrats penned a letter urging Secretary of State Antony Blinken to stop the Zionist regime from moving forward with a settlement plan in E1 area of the West Bank. The move was led by Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan, who recently toured a Palestinian village in the West Bank with New York Representative Jamal Bowman. And Minnesota Representative Betty McCollum has become a strong advocate for Palestinian rights in Congress. The Democrat has sponsored two bills related to U.S. military aid to the Zionist regime and said the state practices apartheid. On the Givat HaShaket proposal, an ongoing settlement expansion in Palestine, McCollum told Min Press in a statement, "The Zionist regime's state-sponsored expansion of settlements on Palestinian land, while the Israeli cabinet bureaucrats deny Palestinian permits to even build homes and bulldoze existing Palestinian homes, schools, and businesses, is destroying the prospect of a Palestinian state and the prospects for peace. The global community views the Israeli settlement expansion as illegal and lethal to any future peace process, and the U.S. government should not be silent. The situation has reached a point in which the Palestinians are clearly a people denied even basic human rights while under Israeli regime subjugation. U.S. lawmakers are emerging as more and more critical of Israeli regime, but that hasn't stopped the Israeli regime violence. In fact, the Zionist regime appears almost fueled by the condemnation." But at the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel alliance is a lot stronger than any notion of democracy or human rights. No U.S. administration wants to be perceived as picking 10 fights every day with Israel, even if Israel is engaging every day in 10 things that really demand a response from the U.S.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.